It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says we shouldn't be pessimistic about the U.S. economy. We're on the verge of reinventing ourselves for the better.
First, President Obama will give his fifth State of the Union address tomorrow, and our guest says it will be little more than a presidential infomercial, more pep rally than policy launch.
So his solution is to turn the State of the Union address into a presidential Q&A, where he has to respond to questions from elected officials.
Here with us to explain his proposal is Doug Brooks, President Emeritus of the International Stability Operations Association. He wrote an opinion piece with Lawrence Korb in the Washington Post called Let's Turn the State of the Union into a Presidential Q&A. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you say that the State of the Union address hasn't always been what you're calling a presidential infomercial. Can you give us a sense what it used to be like?
Well, for about 100 years, it was little more than a letter that was sent by the president to be read by some flunky in Congress. Back in 1913, Woodrow Wilson sort of dusted off the idea of actually talking directly to Congress, and it became at that point, and pretty much on a fairly regular basis now, the president will actually address a joint session of Congress, and you include, of course, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Supreme Court justices as well. But as we've seen, this sort of thing has degenerated literally into a pep rally where half the audience stands for some of his comments, the other half for others, and occasionally everybody stands for some of the comments to cheer. But it's it doesn't really seem to achieve much other than giving the president a chance to sort of, I guess, stand royally above old parts of the government and look in a way that I think Thomas Jefferson would have shunned.
Well, do you think the way it's done now is more just, you know, a comment on the way we do politics in America today and the partisan nature and the way it's so TV-centric rather than really a problem with the State of the Union?
Oh, no, that's probably true. But I guess, you know, what's the point and is the American electorate served by this format? And I don't think it's working particularly well. You see not so many people watching it, and as we say, you know, people are watching reruns of Breaking Bad and basketball games rather than what an address that could be, I think, quite interesting and quite enlightening in terms of what's going on with the government today.
In terms of the political stage, I mean, so much of it is canned, what we see. It's prepackaged. I mean, just about everything on TV is, including reality TV shows. So why should the presidential, you know, why should the State of the Union be any different?
Well, that's a great question. I guess there are some people who think maybe we could have something a little bit more substantive. You know, there's no guarantee that this sort of format would become substantive either. I mean, you can, I think, when you read the comments that we've received, that Larry and I have received on this this idea, a lot of them are saying it would degenerate into exactly what, you know, Fox News or MSNBC is, you know, every day. And that's quite possible. But nevertheless, I think there is a possibility that it could be taken seriously. Obviously, it's something that, you know, it's a thought piece. But if it was grasped onto and both parties said, okay, here's the chance to have some really dignified discussion, maybe something could be achieved. And maybe for an electorate, it might become a little bit more interesting and informative and useful in terms of, I guess, as we say, reinvigorating our democracy.
So you use the word dignified, and I'm curious about that because you propose something that's similar to the Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons, and we actually have a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
Excellent.
Isn't it interesting, Mr. Speaker? The thing they want to talk about least of all is the cost of living crisis facing families up and down the country. And that's because they know that families are worse off. Yes. Now, can he tell us, how much higher is the average gas and electricity bill this Christmas compared to last?
Well, first of all, let us deal with the predictions. He said this.
Order. The question was asked, and the answer must be heard. The Prime Minister.
On this, they have a programme which will clearly lead to the disappearance of a million jobs. Now we have 1.6 million more private sector jobs, 1.2 million more people in work. It is time he apologised for his prediction of talking the economy down.
Now, that is a clip from the Prime Minister's questions. That was the Leader of the Opposition, Edward Miliband, asking a question to Prime Minister David Cameron. That was just last month. Now, I don't know, dignified is definitely rowdy, and there's some substance there. But what do you think that gives us that we don't get out of State of the Union?
Well, that's a great point. And actually, right after we posted our story, a friend of mine, an Australian friend, sent a clip from Australia, which was even more hilarious. Yeah, I mean, this is something that we need to avoid. Obviously, we'd like to. But, you know, as a fallback, it'd certainly be a hell of a lot more entertaining than what we currently have. So, you know, I think it's a win-win either way.
Well, what about the substance? Let's get at that, because you're calling the current State of the Union a presidential infomercial. How could what you're proposing, a presidential question and answer session, provide more substance for the people who are actually watching?
Well, think of it this way. We have three branches of government, and yet they rarely seem to actually talk to each other. I mean, this would be sort of, instead of talking through the TV shows, instead of talking through seconds, they'd essentially, you'd have an opportunity for the lawmakers and the president to be able to have a face-to-face and public conversation on the key issues. I think there could be some value in that. There's a lot of ideas that simply get shunted to one side or another, because if you're not being asked them directly, you don't necessarily have to answer directly. So it would be perhaps the only time when a president and Congress would actually face and talk to each other and have some sort of conversation. Now, obviously, it's incumbent upon, I think, the leaders of the parties and everything to agree that they want to do this in a dignified manner, but I think it could be done, conceivably.
Now, in your piece, you say that it would cause the president to be quick on his feet. He would have to be, you say, quick and clever, and that kind of style would be what would serve it best. But, you know, obviously that's not going to serve all presidents equally, and it might not serve the cause of politics equally either if we reward the clever president over, you know, say, the wise and sagacious
the
president.
Dumb one.
Your word, yeah.
Maybe what that's not a bad thing.
So you think that would cause the cream to rise to the top?
Oh, you would hope. It certainly might be a bit intimidating for some of the potential presidents in the future. But nevertheless, I mean, even a thoughtful president, I think, can probably pull it off. And again, a lot of it depends on the level of dignity you're able to achieve when you do this sort of thing. You know, if it is a circus, then yeah, maybe just having a clown up there would be useful. But if it actually is something where real ideas are being thrown back and forth and discussed and debated right there, then maybe a thoughtful president could do just as well.
Who do you expect would moderate, and how would you get to pick who got to ask the questions?
Well, we propose it would be perhaps the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate, which is a vice president. But I think because of the two-party system, you'd probably want to have the leaders of both parties involved somehow. So most likely, in this case, it probably would be the vice president and the Speaker of the House. But it's conceivable in the future it could be, you know, the ranking member. There could be any numbers of ways that could be decided. I think it'd be important to make sure that the questions, that each party is able to control the questions and make sure that some of the so-called backbenchers are able to get their questions in, as well as the people that everybody sees on TV all the time. So I think it would open up the forum a bit more to representatives that we never really see.
Now, we have something kind of similar to this already. We have town hall meetings. How would this distinguish itself from that?
Well, true. And the town hall meetings, of course, are on a lower a political level, but this would be, yeah, very similar to that. It would be a chance where anything could be brought up. You'd presumably have some questions that would be pre-planned. In other words, if you have a fairly technical question, that could be given to the president, you know, a few days ahead of time to give him or her a chance to prepare. But there could be built into it, you could have a certain number of spontaneous questions, which would be a little bit more challenging and interesting.
So let's say, you know, President Obama's listening right now. He thinks, pretty good idea. I think I might try this. And that's the way we do it. Probably not this year, tomorrow, but, you know, maybe next year. What would change? What would you expect to change?
I think that it would be very interesting. And it would be, I mean, obviously somewhat politically risky. I mean, this whole idea is a long shot. But I think for Obama, he is a clever, I think he is reasonably fast on his feet, and I think he would do well in this particular format. I mean, obviously, he'd have to spend some time prepping and making sure he has, you know, the right answers. But you do that in the political debates anyway, when you're running for office. So I don't think this would be that much of a challenge or that far outside of bounds. So I don't think there, you know, basically it would take some agreement ahead of time, which in this day and age may not be so easy to do, but some political agreement between both sides saying this is a way we want to go. This is something we want to try. And for the Republicans, I mean, they have a lot to gain from this. I mean, right now it's basically a mandatory session where everybody has to sit there stony faced while the president talks at you and provides his thoughts and his ideas and his successes and, you know, his challenges for the future. And the answer that they have, the response, almost nobody watches, and is rarely as interesting or captivating as the original. So I think there's a lot for them to get out of it, and therefore they might be willing to agree to some certain guidelines on dignity, on making sure that it's done in a way that makes it valuable. For the president, it'd be a little bit of a reach, but I think he could create something that would be of incredible value to our democracy for the future.
Well, Doug, it's an interesting idea. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure.
We've been speaking with Doug Brooks, President Emeritus of International Stability Operations Association. He's proposing that tomorrow's State of the Union address be turned into a presidential question and answer session.
In the midst of the recovery from the Great Recession, there's a lot of pessimism about the United States economy out there, with continued long-term unemployment for many, concerns about jobs lost to outsourcing and technology, and rising income inequality, a likely topic tomorrow's State of the Union address.
But our next guest has an optimistic point of view. In a piece that recently ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, he says the U.S. economy is reinventing itself and good news is on the way.
Vivek Wadhwa joins us now from Singularity University. He's a fellow at the Rock Center for Corporate Governance at Stanford University and director of research at the Center for Entrepreneurship and Research Commercialization at Duke University. Vivek, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, as we mentioned, there's a lot of pessimism about the economy. Why don't you feel pessimistic?
Because the country is reinventing itself. If you look at every specific field, I mean, start with manufacturing. Manufacturing is beginning to come back to America. Give it another 5 years, and we'll be having robotics manufacturing plants, and then we'll be building 3D manufacturing plants. We're going to have to start building new factories, training up American workers. We're going to see a revival of manufacturing like we've never imagined before. Look at medicine. There are all sorts of advances happening in medicine. We're now being able to prevent disease. We have all sorts of sensor-based devices which are available for our smartphones, for our bathrooms, all these amazing sensors which can help us prevent disease. Look at energy. Solar has dropped 97.2% over the last 35 years. At the rate at which solar is going, and I'm just talking just about solar, not about many of the other amazing advances, we will achieve grid parity in about 10 years or so. Grid parity means that it's cheaper to buy, to have solar panels than to buy from the grid. Move forward 15 years, and solar will be a fraction of grid. We're talking about unlimited energy. You have unlimited energy. You can have unlimited clean water. You can have unlimited food. The next 10 to 20 years are going to be the most amazing period in human history, and we're laying the seeds for all this innovation right now. America is making it happen.
But looking at manufacturing and other fields, a lot of people might look at this and say, it's great that the manufacturing jobs are coming, but thanks to technology, an individual plant employs fewer people. A lot of jobs, even starting to be knowledge jobs, are being crowded out by new forms of technology. These innovations may be great, but if we don't have jobs to make money, it could be bad news for a lot of people.
Well, I'll ask you the question, why do we have to work 40 hours a week? 100 years ago, we would have been arguing about working 80 hours a week. We would have argued about the importance of protecting agricultural jobs. And then we would have been arguing about protecting factory jobs. Jobs have been changing over the last centuries. We work less now than we ever did. We have more leisure time. Why do we have to work 40 hours a week? Why can't we be working 20 hours a week? If food becomes cheap, if we can 3D print our houses, if we can prevent disease and we don't fall sick, why do we have to make money the way we do right now? We next decade, We're going to be having some very interesting discussions about the value of work and the meaning of work itself. It's going to be changing. We'll be doing less work. We'll have more time for leisure. We'll have more time to uplift ourselves, to gain knowledge for music, for the arts. Those are better pursuits, you know, than just working in jobs that are mindless right now that people hate doing.
So it sounds like you're saying our technology is running out ahead of our economy and our culture, our society.
Exactly. And we don't seem to realize that as human beings, we tend to get pessimistic. We look linearly. Hey, the next iPhone didn't have a major new upgrade and we could become pessimistic. You know, we have to understand that our iPhone now, for example, has 40 times the computing power of supercomputers of about 30 or 40 years ago. We just sit around, they just sit in our pockets waiting for us to do something. Computing has advanced exponentially, and so are many other fields. They're advancing exponentially. And we're now getting to a point that we'll be able to solve many of humanity's problems.
Part of the pessimistic viewpoint is along the lines of economist Tyler Cowen, who was on our show a couple months back. He makes the case that there are some people who are going to do really well. People with education, people with skills, the people who are programming the apps, developing the new technologies. And there'll be a lot of people who can't afford an education to do that or rack up so much debt in education that they'll be burdened by it forever. Do you see that that split coming in our society?
Yes and no. I mean, Tyler is the guy who used to go around talking about how all innovation is dead. We picked all the low-hanging fruits of history. He was an extreme pessimist a few years ago. Now he's talking about, hey, all these amazing things are happening, but we're going to have unemployment. Tyler is selling books by being pessimistic. The fact is that when we start bringing manufacturing back, so we have to build new factories. You don't have to. You don't need a college degree to build a factory. So we're now going to have to rethink our infrastructure, the way we have our roads. When we have self-driving cars on our roads, the job requirements will change. We won't need so many taxi drivers or so many truck drivers. It may well be that you have some people who pursue music and knowledge gathering. The jobs will change. The role of human beings will change. And yes, there will be disruption. There will be more people who are the extreme rich. We'll have more Mark Zuckerbergs. But the rest of, for example, cell phones. 15 years ago, the cell phone used to be an object of luxury. If you go back to that movie, Wall Street, Michael Douglas had that big brick in his hand, and that was the image we saw of the super rich. I was in New Delhi 2 weeks ago. My beggar's cell phone went off. He stopped begging. But the point is that now a billion people in India have cell phones. They've become objects of, they've become a sheer necessity. So the cost of technology is dropping. It's commercial. It's democratizing. Everyone is beginning to have it. And we're going to have different discussions than just having haves and have-nots. We're going to have the have-nots have so much more, knowledge. So much more food and lodging, and many of their basic needs will be taken care of. So it could well be that some people work more than others do, but it's going to be a set of very interesting discussions we have over the next 10 to 20 years.
One thing that struck me in your piece, we hear a lot about how the internet has changed the economy. You say we haven't seen much yet. It's still a really new technology in the scope of things. There's a lot more to come.
Yeah, there are going to be 3 billion more people coming online in this decade. Cheap tablet computers. I was involved with a project to bring cheap tablets from India to Palo Alto, Oakland, and Mountain View. We gave it to the disadvantaged children over here. It's sad that there's tens of thousands of children over here who don't have laptops or computers, which are a basic necessity. We brought $40 computers from India and gave it to these kids. Many of them said it changed their lives because now they had access to the same internet, to the same knowledge, to the same ability to build apps as the rich kids in Silicon Valley did. So the cost of tablet computers is dropping exponentially. Soon everyone will go around having iPad-like devices by which they communicate. Just like we have cell phones, we'll have smartphones and smart tablets, and they'll become inexpensive. The way we'll be able to communicate will just change. It's going to lead to an era of information sharing.
In our last 30 seconds or so, is the United States particularly well poised in this innovative future?
That's the beauty of it. We're making this innovation happen. We are the inventors of this technology. We're going to be the leading beneficiaries of this thing. And the U.S. is reinventing itself once again. I'm extremely optimistic about America. It's going to rise. It's going to prosper. It's going to flourish.
Vivek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Vivek Wadhwa. He's Vice President of Research and Innovation at Singularity University. He's also affiliated with Duke and Stanford universities.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're listening to the song Cut Me Some Slack from the album Sound City, Reel to Reel, which snagged a Grammy for Viroqua, Wisconsin native Butch Vig. The album is the soundtrack to Foo Fighter frontman Dave Grohl's documentary Sound City. Vig, who produced the album, walked away with his third Grammy last night, this one for Best Compilation Soundtrack for Visual Media.
And coming up, we'll talk with Cindy McCain about her push to strengthen human trafficking laws around the Super Bowl.
First, the Arctic blast hitting Wisconsin today probably feels pretty familiar to our next guests. This winter, the father-daughter team just came back from a wilderness adventure in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, where they lived and worked alongside the only year-round hunter-gatherers there, 130 miles above the Arctic Circle.
James Campbell and his daughter Aiden join us now. They're here to talk about their time in the Arctic winter. James is a Wisconsin writer and adventurer. Aiden is his 15-year-old daughter. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
And Aiden, so great to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
So you guys were guests on Wisconsin Public Radio before you set off for your adventure, and we're so glad you could come back and tell us what happened while you were up there. I'm sure people were dying of curiosity. So James, let's start with you. Can you set the stage for us, describe where you were and just how remote this place actually was?
Well, Haimo and Edna Korth, Haimo happens to be my first cousin. He's from Appleton. He went up there in the 70s. But he and Edna live in the middle of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in the southern foothills of the Brooks Range, 130 miles north of the Arctic Circle and 100 miles from the nearest neighbor, 200 miles from the nearest road. So they live more remotely, perhaps, than any family in North America.
My goodness. So how do you get there?
The bush plane is kind of the time machine in Alaska. It's the only way to reach Haimo and Edna's cabin on the Colleen River. It's 242 air miles from Fairbanks. So its Anchorage is closer to Fairbanks than Haimo and Edna's cabin is.
Wow. Well, so my next question is why? Why would you do this? Aiden, you're still in high school. This is challenging, I think, for anybody of any age. And, you know, to take your child somewhere that's dark, you know, they're in the period of round-the-clock darkness, I think, can be dangerous. What were you hoping to get out of a trip like this, Aiden?
Well, for me, it was quite an adventure, and I was happy to get out of school to go up to Alaska. Actually, coming back, it's been difficult to readjust. Life seems so mundane now compared to my adventure up in Alaska. But I learned a lot while I was up there. I think many people have a nostalgia for the simple way of life, and my grandfather always talks about his fondest memories growing up on a farm. But what they don't talk about as much is the work involved with that way of life. And every single day, there are things that have to be done, no matter the temperature, no matter the circumstances. You have to go get water. You have to chop wood. I mean, that way of life requires that. So
you went there to work with Haimo and Edna, his wife? So you were there to just sort of experience the wilderness?
Well, not entirely. I'm writing a book about it. I'm writing a book about the father-daughter bond. Oddly enough, there don't seem to be many father-daughter books. There are a lot of father-son books, but no father-daughter books. And I'm blessed with three daughters. So Aiden being the first. So I'm writing a book about the father-daughter bond and how that plays out in the wilderness and how kids, adults actually, and teenagers and young kids can learn from the wilderness, can learn lessons in common sense and independence and self-sufficiency, and also kind of the restorative powers of being in the outdoors that have gotten kind of short shrift in the modern world. But so this was kind of part and parcel of writing that book, and we're going to make four trips to the Arctic. We're working on a spring trip, and our really big one will be this summer.
Oh, okay. And is it all going to be with you, Aiden?
Yes, I get to come along. I'm my dad's sidekick.
Adventure sidekick.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the day-to-day work that went into just being there for 3.5 weeks. What was an average day like?
So, well, Haimo and Edna always go off on the trap line. Each of them have their own trap line. Edna is a walking trap line, has a walking trap line, and she sets snares, bunny snares, near the cabin and across the river, which I got to help out with, and she taught me how to snare bunnies. They're actually called snowshoe hares, but they call them bunnies up there. And Haimo goes out every day on the trap line, which can be 20-mile loop. It's on the river or in the woods.
In the mountains, yeah. But we got up early in the morning, and we had to split. We had to cut, split, and haul wood. We had to keep our tent warm. They had a little leaky wood stove in the tent. So Aiden knows all about that, getting up in the middle of the night. We got up five times a night to stoke it. We had to haul our water. We were out hunting or on the trap line every day. And as Aiden said before, it is just, it's work, work, and more work.
And it's winter.
It is winter.
Another W. So it's work and winter. Can you put in perspective? So, you know, Wisconsinites, we're all freaking out about this weather. Aiden, you're out of school. Your school was canceled. Most schools are. How does this compare to the cold that you saw when you were above the Arctic Circle?
Well, as my dad said, today would be balmy where we were. But once you come back, you adjust pretty quickly. And This does feel cold. As a Wisconsinite, I'm cold right now. But the Alaskan Aiden says, oh, this is a wonderful day. Let's go out. Let's have fun. Why was school canceled?
Oh, wow. So wind chills must be pretty extreme, James, up there, I imagine.
Yeah. The coldest temperature we experienced, and we were lucky, was 40, 45 below. Mm. But last year, at this time of year, on the Colleen River, Haimo records temperatures, and it was 55 degrees below zero or colder for a five-week stretch. And you can imagine, I mean, that is just brutal cold. Plus, and that's not including wind chill, and because the Colleen River is a wide river valley, the wind whips off the brook, off the Arctic Ocean and then off the Brooks Range and comes barreling down the river valley, and it is just like nothing I've ever experienced. It is just cold.
So imagine nothing showing. You have to just have every little patch of skin covered. Is that how you would dress?
Yes, you definitely layer up. I remember my dad was very protective and caring, and he dressed me like a five-year-old in the morning. And he'd come over and hand me my hand warmers, hand me my foot warmers, help me get on my coat, my snow pants, my bunny boots, everything. You can't, every piece of skin is covered.
Were you ever scared up there? Were there moments where you thought, you know, this is a little bit much, and I think maybe Dad, you know, went around the bend on this one?
Well, I was scared, but I always had someone looking out for me, too. But there are many things to be scared of. I mean, it's such a foreign environment that cold is brutal, and there's always the fear of bears, which in
would
the winter
would it be polar bears up there?
Oh, winter grizzly bears.
Okay.
So, winter bears haven't taken in enough calories to go into hibernation. So we saw winter bear tracks, but luckily we never saw a winter bear. Those can be scary.
And what about you? I mean, being scared isn't something that only, you know, young feel.
No,
were you ever frightened up there, James?
Yeah, Haimo, you know, not being the alpha predator, being in grizzly bear country is, I don't know if you've ever experienced, but it is an unsettling feeling, regardless of how accustomed to the wilderness you are. And what Aiden didn't mention about her winter bear experience is that the winter bear does come out of hibernation because it hasn't taken in enough calories, but it is hungry, and it has to satisfy that hunger. So the first thing, it will stalk and kill a human being. And everybody fears the winter bear, but also I was on the trap line with Haimo, and we would go by snow machine 20, 30 miles above the cabin, and we had some snow machine problems. We rolled the snow machine a few times.
What's a snow machine?
A snowmobile. They call it a snow machine up there because it's a work vehicle. It's not a tavern-to-tavern vehicle.
Right. I see. Okay, that's different.
So we rolled it, and then we couldn't start it after that. We flooded it. And I thought, my God, we're going to have to walk, and on a number of occasions, 30 miles back to the cabin. Mm. And what we'd have to do is just strip off as many clothes as we could to keep and still stay warm and try to walk back to the cabin. I almost had to do that on countless occasions. Fortunately, we didn't have to do it. But that's very scary.
Oh, yeah, that would be. And the winter bear thing, that sounds like a whole new level of things to be concerned about. One bright spot, your birthday. Right? You had your birthday up there.
At my age, I don't know if it's such a bright spot, but I guess maybe I should just be thankful for being around.
Tell us about your birthday meal.
Our birthday meal, we had caribou heart. They eat everything. That's the great sin up there, not to eat everything. Beaver tail and Alaskan king salmon. And Edna also made me a pie with cranberries. So we were sitting there. And enjoying my birthday, they sang happy birthday to me very quickly. And all of a sudden, we heard the bush plane buzz us. We were 4 days late. He was 4 days late to get us because of winter weather. And he buzzed us, and Haimo got on the radio and said, "What's going on?" He said, "I'm here to get him, and this is our only window of opportunity. Get him down there as fast as they can. It's 45 degrees below zero. The plane is going to freeze up. We're going to get ice on the wings, and we won't be able to take off." So we just, Aiden and I just flew. We just threw everything we had into our bags. My wonderful birthday dinner was cut short, though. I still had slobber all over my chin and all over my ugly beard. And we flew back that night. It was really amazing. And I don't know if we have time, but I'd like to describe this. We took off on the gravel bar in the middle, in complete darkness. It's like a sandbar. And then we circled. We went north to the Brooks Range and came back, and the only light for miles and miles and miles was Haimo and Edna's cabin light tucked there in the woods. And then we flew back by the light of the half moon back to Fairbanks. And as we neared the Yukon River, we saw some of the village lights of Chalkeetsuk and some of the other villages. And then we got over the White Mountains and eventually saw Fairbanks. But it was absolutely magical and surreal. And really a beautiful way to end our trip. But I didn't get to eat my entire meal. So
of caribou heart and
right, exactly.
beaver tail. Well, that does sound spectacular. Well, we're talking right now with James Campbell, Wisconsin native, and the author of The Final Frontiersman. Joining us is his 15-year-old daughter, Aiden, who went along for a 3.5-week adventure with her dad in the Arctic wilderness.
And you can join the conversation. If you're holed up now because of the cold weather today, you can ask your cold weather survival questions or find out what it's like way, way north of here. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with a father and daughter team who embrace the wild on a wilderness adventure to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We're hearing about their journey and what the deep cold is like, even colder, I guess, farther north of here.
And you can join the conversation. If you have a question about what it's like to travel north of the Arctic Circle, or if you've done it, you could share your questions and your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Now, Aiden and James, one thing we haven't talked about is the darkness. What was it like being in round-the-clock darkness, Aiden?
Well, the sun set on November 28th, and it won't rise again until late January. And it's like dusk, so it's gray, and you never see the sun. So we're so used to seeing that sun overhead. But it's not there. And sometimes you can see it's just struggling to come up over the horizon. And sometimes then you get kind of a rosy light that's beautiful, but you never see it.
But it's not pitch black, it sounds like.
It's gray.
Dusky.
It's very gray.
It sounds moody. Did you get, I don't know, was it hard on your morale when it was, when there's no sun?
No, I don't really think, for me, I didn't have that issue. What happened? It's difficult to describe because it's a reflection. So you see the light, but you never see the sun.
So you just have to have faith.
Yes,
it's actually there.
What's that great word? The gloaming. That's kind of what it's like.
Constant gloaming.
Yeah.
Now, earlier, James, you mentioned there being a lot of literature out there speaking to father and son bonding. What's special about doing it with your daughters?
Well, I guess in part because it's just unconventional. I also always thought I would have sons, and I obviously didn't. But I wanted to always treat my treat my daughter in a kind of gender neutral way. And I always thought, well, I would do this with my son, so I certainly am going to do it with my daughter. And Aiden's been very game and very adventurous, and she's a great traveling partner. Not that there weren't issues, of course. You know, we had our moments, and there were tensions, and we had our arguments, and I'm sure she thought I was the worst father in the world at times. But I think it's both challenged our friendship and enhanced our friendship. So I'm glad we could do this. Aiden might not feel the same, but I do.
Do you feel the same?
I do. I thought it was a great experience to have, because when you're in that kind of environment, and especially you're in the cabin, or in our case, in a tent with that person for 3.5 weeks, and there are only 3 other people up there. So you become very close with those people, and you depend on them to boost your morale. So we would have sheep's head games together at night, or we would go out walking, and Edna and I spent a lot of time together, and I think I became so close with Haimo and Edna and my dad when I was up there.
So lots of beautiful closeness that came out of being, you know, so isolated altogether. What drove you crazy about each other?
Oh, man. Let me count
the
ways.
Anything you can share on the radio? Yeah. Well, Aiden didn't want to get up and chip off the stove or something?
Well, you know, at night,
That's true.
At night, the fire, we had this tiny little wood stove, and it would burn through the woods so fast. And you'd light the stove, and you'd almost be cooked out of the tent. And then 45 minutes later, an hour later, you'd feel the cool kind of creeping in. And then an hour and a half later, you were bitterly cold. Mm. You know, we'd sleep through the coals, and we'd have to get up and light the tent, light the stove again. And Aiden and I worked out a system where she would light it once or twice a night, but I had to do it the majority
that
of the
fair.
Time.
That's wrong.
Yeah,
with that,
right. That's fair. Right. And so we had our squabbles. But by and large, there were, you know, no big blowouts.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, you're both still back here.
Mm-hmm.
So you've made the case that there's something special about doing it with your daughter, bringing your daughter on this adventure. But also the wilderness is part of this, isn't it? What is it that you see as being sort of the gift of sharing the wilderness with your child?
Well, last time we were here, Aiden talked about the wilderness letter that I gave her, Wallace Stegner's wilderness letter about why we need wilderness in our lives. And he talked about the geography of hope and the birth of awe, two lines that I absolutely love. But I think we all need wilderness in our lives. We need wildness in our lives. And Haimo certainly does. He's one of those guys that, as Elda Leopold said, can't live without wildness, as is Edna. But it's also just about getting out in your backyard. I mean, you don't have to go to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Just get out in your back woodlot or go to the park. And that just, it restores you physically, it restores you emotionally, or at least it does me. And I think Aiden could probably say the same thing.
What about you? What do you think your concept of the wilderness is after having gone up there a couple of times?
Well, it's not a place. Many people think of the wilderness as a place to contemplate these great ideas like humanity, one's life. But it involves a lot of work, too, living that way, as I said before. But there is something that the wilderness brings. Wallace Stegner said, especially for the young, it brings sanity into our insane lives. And I think that's true. It makes you think of the necessities, the only things you need, and that's what's truly important. And that's a lesson I learned up there.
So the necessities, so do you mean, I guess, the food, the shelter, the kind of square one things, or do you mean something bigger than that, too?
I think both the square one things. You can live without the luxuries. There's also the people you need and the people you rely on. I really, while I was up there, I was without my mom and my sisters, but I really depended on Haimo's wife, Edna. And she taught me, she told me she was going to make me into a woodswoman. And that was her goal. She's kept on saying, I'm going to make you tough. And she taught me how to set bunny snares, how to shoot a gun from a kneeling position. She taught me a lot while I was up there. But I think she taught me I could survive and be tough and be independent and self-reliant. And I think I learned a lot from her. And she's a very special person in my life.
Well, and there is a lot of craziness, I guess, in the world today, depending on how you feel about a lot of the modern technology, all the stuff when you're a teenager. There's Facebook and Twitter and, you know, Snapchat and what have you, and, you know, all the crazy social stuff that goes along with being a teenager in school. When you came back, had anything changed with the way you saw that or the way you saw yourself as part of that?
I think in a way it was a difficult transition for me. While I was in Alaska, I was very nostalgic about life at home and my family and school. But when I came back, it was a difficult adjustment. I had to, it was the people. It was something you've experienced up there. Something had happened to me, and it was difficult to convey that. I lived through so many things, and I had so many adventures and crazy experiences that my life at home seemed boring and simple. And that's something I've gotten accustomed to, and now I like the mundaneness of it. But I miss Alaska and the adventures I've had up there.
What about you? What do you miss about Alaska, James?
Oh, man. I grew up thinking I was going to be a mountain man. And when I came of age, I went east to Connecticut. And they don't make mountain men in Connecticut. And so I never got to be a mountain man. So by being up there, by being a part of that whole experience, both writing the first book and now this book, I get to live out a portion of my dream. And who would think that a middle-aged man could ever live out, you know, some childhood dream? So it's really been unique for me, and also just the astounding beauty. I mean, Haimo, they look onto the Brooks Range. You go 10 miles north, and you're in treeless tundra, and you're looking at the white, icy, snow-filled Brooks Range, and it is incredible.
Oh, sounds beautiful. Thank you for sharing it with us. For those of us who'll never make it, thank you for telling us about it. And thank you. Thank you, James.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
And thank you, Aiden.
Thank you.
And thanks for making the trek on an icy Wisconsin day. James Campbell is a Wisconsin writer and adventurer. He and his daughter, Aiden, just returned from a wilderness adventure above the Arctic Circle.